Let's be honest. No two horses are the same. So why do so many of us feed them like they are? At Tribute Equine Nutrition, our equine nutrition specialists help you create personalized feeding plans based on your horses and your goals. All of our feeds are backed by a 100% money-back guarantee made in our own ionophore-free facilities and are fixed formulas you can trust. And if you're new to Tribute, your first bag is free, so you can try it with confidence. Take the stress out of feeding your horse. Visit TributeEquineNutrition.com to get started and let them know Dressage Today sent you.
You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Dressage Today podcast, sponsored by Kentucky Performance Products, also known throughout the horse world as KPP. This month, we are revisiting a previously recorded podcast from before my time with Dressage Today, but with a great reason. We're bringing you the original interview with Chelsea Kennedy from Stephanie Ruff and Aviva on August 24th, 2021. The reason we're revisiting this interview is that Chelsea has a new book out, and we're looking forward to getting her back on the podcast to talk to us about her latest book. We thought it would be great for people to hear her original story so they could be up to date when we interview her later this year. So whether you heard it on the original interview or this is your first time hearing about Chelsea, we hope you enjoy this podcast. As always, if you enjoy the content we put out, please subscribe, hit the like button, and share with your friends. We have received a few more elk questions, but please keep them coming. You can submit elk questions to us at any of our social media handles listed on the transcript. And now for a word from our sponsor. Is your horse suffering from respiratory problems like intermittent coughing, nasal discharge, seasonal allergies, poor performance, or difficulty breathing during exercise? Kentucky Performance Products has a new supplement, AirWise, that can help. Formulated using a synergistic blend of high-quality, potent antioxidants and micronutrients, AirWise is research-proven to help horses maintain healthy respiratory function. It's been shown to promote normal respiratory rates, enhance lung function, support a healthy inflammatory response in airways, and maintain immune health. To see if AirWise is right for your horse, speak with your veterinarian, as it is available through veterinarians, or you can visit kppusa.com or call them at 859-873-2974.
Later on, we'll have an interesting conversation with professional event and dressage rider Chelsea Kennedy. Chelsea incorporates a lot of groundwork and mindfulness into her dressage program, and we look forward to learning more about that. But first, we're going to jump right into a serious topic. Aviva, you spend a lot of time teaching your own students and doing clinics in your area. What to you makes a good student?
You know, Stephanie, that's just such a fabulous question. You know, we talk a lot about how do you find a good dressage instructor or trainer or whatever, but we don't always talk about what makes a good student. And, you know, I joke that I have a certain teaching style and my students sort of self-select out at times because they don't work with me. And that is true because we all are individual in our styles. But
I was going to say, I think that probably happens across the board. That happens with everyone. Yeah. Not everyone is suitable for everyone. You know?
Yeah. And a trainer needs to learn how to train, how to reach people, how to educate. But there is a certain responsibility on the student as well, I think. And for me, there are a few things that make a good student. And I think the very first thing is the desire to learn. We all talk about the student who comes week after week after week and has the same lesson over and over and over again. And there's never any progress because the person is just making excuses and just going through the motions. Yeah. You know, I want somebody who is doing their homework. I want somebody who has humility who has an eagerness to learn, who leaves their ego, you know, at the arena and says, I'm here to learn, not to be told that I'm good.
Yeah.
And, you know I struggled with this as a student as well. I kid about the fact that I get physically sick before my lessons, and I get very nervous, and it's almost as if I'm going to a competition, and it's because my trainer's opinion matters to me.
Yeah.
I want to show her that I've been doing the heavy lifting behind the scenes, that I am improving, that I am understanding, that I am getting better. And I want to see that with my students as well. And it's not necessarily that they go from, you know, intro riders to FEI riders in a year.
Right.
I don't care about the degree of progress. It's that I want to see that they are making progress, that they feel happy with where they're going, that when things get scary or difficult, that they don't just throw up their hands and say, let's find a golden key to get around this, that they want to work through the difficult processes of learning and training. You know, I joke a lot about the fact that dressage is hard. You know, if it was easy, we would all go to the Olympics,
right?
And we'd all be getting gold medals, and we're not. You know, it takes a very special rider to get there. It takes a very special horse to get there. And there aren't a whole lot of them out there, but that's true in all sports. But what we can all be is better riders. And I think that the good student is one who comes into the lesson open.
Yeah.
You know, we all make excuses, you know, oh, well, my leg hurts and I can't do that. Or, oh, well, you know, I'm whatever. And okay, make the excuse, but now I want you to try.
Right.
I had a trainer at one point who did not allow me to ask questions. Mm-hmm. She would tell me to do something and I'd say, I don't understand. And she'd say, just do it. And there were times that was really wonderful, because I remember one lesson I had with her and she said, just do it. And I thought that what she was asking me to do was one thing, but what she was asking me to do was the aids for a shoulder in. And I did what she told me without any expectations. And I got a perfect shoulder in.
Mm-hmm.
And if she had told me, I'm giving you the aids for shoulder in, I probably wouldn't have listened to her.
Right.
So being a student is sometimes knowing when to ask a question. And also respecting when sometimes the trainer says to me, just do it.
Stop thinking so much.
Yeah, don't think about it. Just do it.
Right.
And a good trainer knows when to say those things.
Exactly. Yeah.
But a good student also respects that the trainer knows what he or she is talking about and makes the effort to try. You know, none of us wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to ride badly today. You know, I think I'll yank on my horse a little bit and, you know, ride like a sack of potatoes all over the saddle and maybe jam my spurs into my horse. And I'm just going to look like crap. You know, we're all doing the best we can at any moment.
Right.
And some days we don't ride really well. Some days something does hurt, or there is something emotional. And I know that Chelsea is going to talk about mindfulness and, you know, being present in the moment, and that's all well and good, but we're human beings. And sometimes we're not always that good at it. And we do, you know, bring that, I was sitting in traffic for an hour.
Right.
And I'm really stressed and I'm really anxious, or I just got word that somebody I love and care for is sick and I can't get that out of my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, being aware of that and being able to share that with the trainer. You know, I know my students pretty well. I mean, I got involved in a conversation online at one point about how an instructor becomes a little bit of a therapist at times.
It is so true. And sometimes,
yeah,
good, bad, or otherwise, it ends up, there's a huge psychology sort of aspect to it sometimes. Yeah.
I'm a trained social worker. I have a master's degree in social services. I had a private practice for a while. I did hypnotherapy for a while. And I find that all of the skills that I developed as a social worker, I use as a horseback riding instructor.
Yeah.
You know, there is a certain degree of therapy. And it's not that I want to know how you feel about your mother,
right?
What's going on in your marriage, but I need to know where your fear is. And I need you to be open to telling me things so that I can help you learn. And I know when I work with a student for the very first time, one of the first questions that I ask is there anything that your horse does that scares you? And it's not that I want to know that you're a chicken.
Yeah.
It's not that I want to know that your horse is a jerk and, you know, tends to spend most of his ride on his hind legs. But I want to know where your fear is so that I can help work around the fear. Because if you are so fearful of cantering that you can't, how can I help you learn to canter?
Right.
But if you can be honest with me and say, I'm afraid of not cantering, but I'm afraid of the transition because he likes to buck, then we can work through some ways to get into the transition without bucking. So I want a student who is willing to learn, who is honest about their handicaps, whether they be mental or physical, who is able to say when I say, it can be frustrating as I'll get it, I will say, you know, I say, do you, can you feel it? That's it. Do you feel it? And then I get the no.
No.
And you know, I want to go wring your neck because you should be because it's really good right now. And then it's okay. Let's stop and let's talk about
right.
what the feeling is. Because,
but at least they're being honest and saying, no, I don't feel it, instead of just saying yes, because they don't, and they don't want to, you know, address the fact that they don't feel it because,
feel
you know,
stupid.
Right, exactly, because they feel stupid.
Feel
so,
stupid.
No, it is absolutely better to be honest and say, no, I don't feel it, so that, like you said, then you can stop and explain or, you know, do
you
something
know,
to try to get them to feel.
You know, a lot of people have an issue when they're first learning about trot lengthenings. And, you know, I joke with them and I say, when you think it's good, that's when it's wrong. When you feel it and it feels really expressive, basically your horse is throwing its front end around and it's
right.
hollow. When you have a really good lengthening, it's a real subtle feel.
Yeah.
You're not really going to feel that. You'll feel your horse rock back a little bit. You'll feel the horse take you a little bit,
yeah.
But it isn't this exceptional feeling that we all think it is. So being able to say to a rider, what you just got was great, and having them believe me
yeah.
is really important to me
yeah.
as well. I think that you have to have faith in your trainer. I want a student who's going to question me, but who's also going to believe in me.
Right.
So I think there's a lot to being a good student, but probably the most important part of it is the willingness to be bad at it.
and the willingness to be bad at it and the desire to want to get better.
Exactly. I started doing some groundwork with Leo, with my trainer. And what my trainer said to me was, it's really hard and you're going to do it badly for a while.
Right.
But the way to learn is to be willing and to be humble and to do it poorly until you learn how to do it well.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't spring forward as capable riders. We tend to forget there was a time when we learned how to post.
Yeah, yeah.
We were bad to begin with, but we've become better. And in some cases, we've become good. So a student is one who was willing to embrace the crap in order to move forward to the good.
And I think we probably find this in dressage riders because of the nature of dressage being so meticulous and detail oriented, the people who ride dressage tend to be meticulous and detail oriented
yeah.
and a little bit of a perfectionist kind of thing. And I think because I've run into this in my own riding, being afraid to make the mistake. And I've been told by more than one instructor, you know, like, go for it. Don't be, you know, be afraid to make a mistake because you're going to make a mistake, but at least you're trying. And, you know, but in our desire to be perfect,
yes.
we then don't do anything. And yes, you know, and I'm sure you see this a lot when you're judging, because I got that a lot, because I was always, I tend to be conservative because mm-hmm. I don't want to make mistakes. So it's exactly what you said, being willing to be bad and make mistakes and know that that's not the be all end all. You know, your horse is not going to go, well, she gave me the wrong canter aid 2 weeks ago, so I'm now not going to canter.
Exactly. And the only way that we and our horses learn to communicate with one another is, you know, we don't get angry, or we shouldn't get angry with our horses when our horses make a mistake.
Right.
So we shouldn't be angry with ourselves when we make a mistake, because
you
that's
are absolutely
how we
right.
learn.
And yet yeah. sometimes we do, or we get frustrated at ourselves, or we don't yeah. want to try because we don't want to mess up, but that is part of the learning process.
Exactly.
So, you know, so yes, well, whew, okay.
That was heavy for this morning. Okay.
All right. Oh my goodness. But no, but it is very true. And you know, and I think the psychology aspect to what you say is very, very true, especially because a lot of exactly what you said, a lot of the people that you work with, or that most of the people out there, this is, you know, they're serious about their horses, but it's not their profession. It's not their, you know, it's not their job all day, every day. So they do bring a lot of other stuff to the table, because they do have full-time jobs, other, you know, and they do have families. And I'm not saying professional horse people don't, because they do as well, but you know, this is their, in some ways, this is their like stress relief and their escape and stuff, but
it's supposed to be fun.
It's supposed to be fun. So yeah. So learning how to, you know, try to let go of some of the everything else that's weighing them down, so that you can be open to learning and relaxing and having fun and, you know, and all of that. And part of that's on the trainer too, to be able to create that environment of, you know, learning, but also being able to have fun and being able to laugh at yourself and take it seriously, but not so seriously that, you know.
Exactly. You know, it shouldn't ruin your day if you have a bad lesson.
Right.
Although I'm not one to talk.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, yeah, no, yeah. Like good
it
lessons
shouldn't.
Will make your day. Bad lessons will make you go, oh.
Yes.
But no, it shouldn't ruin your day. But yeah, you know, it's always a work in progress.
Absolutely. That's that whole patience thing again.
It is. Yes, it is. I think that's going to be a recurring theme.
Yes, I think so.
But yeah, so I think we can always strive to be better instructors and better students all the way around. And that makes us better horse people.
I agree.
We are going to move into our Ask the L segment. So this question is one that's a little more personal to you specifically, Aviva, and it comes from Sue.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite test or favorite level to judge? And what is it and why?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I have to say, probably my favorite test to judge is first level test 2. There's just something about the test that just has lovely flow for me. And I feel as if it gives me a real entry into the rider and the horse's training and basics. I think it's just a one of the best written tests that we have right now. I mean, I have tests that I don't enjoy judging as much. I have to admit that training level test 3 with that serpentine that nobody rides well is one of those tests, you know. And, you know, first level test 3 with that leg yield off the rail is always really hard to judge because it's a very difficult movement. But first 2 just feels as if it sets the riders up to do well. Every movement flows into the next one. Every movement is inviting. And I just think it can showcase the relationship and the harmony between the horse and rider in ways that none of the other tests do. But if you were to ask me my favorite, level to judge. And, you know, I'm a graduate of the L program, so technically I can only judge at schooling shows from intro level to second level, although right. I do get people who come at third, fourth, and all of the FEI levels, as well as the eventing tests and, you know, yeah. Western dressage and gated and all the rest of that. But given all of the tests out there to judge and all of the levels out there to judge, I think the one that I like the most is second level. And it's because it is such a difficult level.
It is.
We joke about it, you know, separating the ponies from the horses. Mm-hmm. It just is so challenging. It's the horses finally now consistently on the bit. You're looking for honest collection, maybe not 100% of the test, but real collection. You're looking for suppleness. The aids are now a little bit more subtle. Things happen really fast in second level.
Yeah.
And when you see a really well-written second level test, I mean, yeah, we all love watching Grand Prix and we love watching the Olympics. And, you know, most of us sort of look at that as, yeah, I'm never going to do that. But second level is something that every rider and every horse can achieve.
Yep.
Truly can achieve. Yep. Are you going to get a 75%? Maybe not. But there isn't a horse out there that can't do a credible second right. level test if the rider does things well.
Right.
And so for me, judging second level is just a pleasure when it's done extremely well.
Yeah.
I was scribing for one of my favorite judges, Ken Barbosa, many, many years ago. And a friend of mine came in the ring to ride a second level test. And she rode an absolutely beautiful test. And at the end of the test, and it was a very high scoring test, at the end of the test, Kim turned to me and she said, "This is a horse who is an absolutely perfect second level horse. There's no struggle. He's doing everything with ease. He's not quite ready to move up to third level. He doesn't have that level of collection or extension, quite that much suppleness. But this horse is meeting the challenges of second level in complete harmony with the rider." And that has stuck with me for more than a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And making the move as a rider, well, and as a horse, making that move, that transition from first level to a good second level is really hard because there is a big difference, you know, there's a big difference between first level and second level. So it is hard, but I would agree that when you get it, when you get good at second level, yeah, everything is really nice.
Yeah.
I would agree. And it flows, but it's tough. And I've heard that from many, many people as well, that they're all horses and riders should be able to do at least second level. Like you said, whether or not it's going to set the world on fire, but as far as the movements and everything, second level is doable for, it doesn't matter what your horse's breed is or size or, you know, anything like that. They can learn to do all the movements of second level competently.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's just fun to see it when it's done well.
Yes. Very yeah. good. Well, I would agree with you. Not that it matters, but I would agree. And so we love the questions that we're getting. I'm sure you love them, right, Aviva?
Oh, they're awesome. Yeah, yeah. They really make me think.
Hey, keeps you on your toes. So yes. That's good. But we love the questions that we're getting, and we're always open for more. So if you have a question about showing or judging that you would like Aviva to answer, you can email us or reach out to us on Dressage Today's social media.
When we return, our conversation with Chelsea Kennedy. Chelsea Kennedy grew up in Connecticut, where she was a member of the Litchfield Pony Club, earning her HA certificate before leaving for college. After riding throughout college, she moved to Northeast Tennessee, where her eyes were opened to some horsemanship ideas and tools that she had never seen before.
She tweaked and utilized those tools as she expanded her business to a large facility in Virginia, bringing several horses up the levels in dressage and eventing before selling them for their owners and running a private client's business as well. After meeting her husband, she moved back to the Northeast, where both of their families are, and pared her business down to just a few clients while focusing on social work. She began exploring meditation, which became a huge part of her going forward. Over the last 10 years, and while having two children, her clientele has grown immensely, and horses have become her full-time business again. As Chelsea says, "I am in this business in a much healthier and more sustainable way than I was in my early days, which allows me to help my horses and my clients so much more effectively." Chelsea is currently based in Wales, Maine, and is helping connect riders in Area 1 to the bustling world of upper-level eventing through her network of fellow professional riders, clinic opportunities, and her new home base at Unexpected Farm.
Chelsea, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So, kind of to start with, we'd like to find out a little bit more about your background. And so how did you get interested in horses and riding?
So I got to it a little later in my life than a lot of people. My family had nothing to do with horses whatsoever, except that my grandfather enjoyed thoroughbred racing, but nobody rode in my family. So I was in Girl Scouts as a young child, and my mom sent me to sleepaway camp. I think I was probably 10, and I got to do horse camp there. And so that was like, that started the ball rolling for sure. Once I was in, I was in. And when I got back from camp, she basically said, "Do you want to do dance lessons or do you want to ride?" And it was no questions, definitely riding. And from there, I just found a barn to basically work a little at so I could keep riding, because we didn't have a ton of money and it's not a cheap sport, as you all know. And it just kept going. I joined Pony Club shortly after and never stopped.
It's kind of funny. A lot of our stories are sort of the same. You know, you start, yeah. you get introduced to it one way or another. You have a choice to make. The choice is horses. And then it just snowballs from there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Just takes over your entire life.
Really, 100%. And I wouldn't really have it any other way. You know, I've tried my hand at a couple other things. And always, always, always come back to the horses.
Yeah. So who were your mentors or people that have influenced you and your riding over the years?
Well, I grew up in Connecticut, so in New England, and I rode with a then event rider and now dressage rider named Virginia Leary. Her and her husband Jack were big into the eventing scene in New England for a lot of years. And so she really helped me get my start. And then I was fortunate to fall in with a trainer named Steve Milne, who was from the West Coast originally as a show jumper and an event rider. And he coached our pony club, and he continues to be just one of the best horsemen I've ever known. He is one of those people who just never, ever stops learning. He's like an encyclopedia of historical info and current training ideas, and he never stops collecting information. And he really instilled in me the idea that the training process is always more important than how things look in any, you know, one small moment to other people. So that he was a huge, huge influence in my riding work and continues to be. And then I lived in Virginia for quite a lot of years and got to compete against and really keep my eye on people who were coming up in the eventing world, like Boyd Martin and Will Coleman and Doug Payne and Buck Davidson. Yeah. And then obviously all of their predecessors were there in those competitions too, you know, Philip Dutton and the O'Connors and Bruce Davidson. So that really had a huge influence on my, you know, kind of young career on my own as a professional. And then luckily for me, in the past several years, I've been really fortunate to be connected with Tick Maynard and his wife, Sinead. Mm-hmm. And working with Tick really, you know, turned my eye again from where Steve started it even more fully to some of the best original horsemen in the U.S., like Ray Hunt and Tom Durant and Buck Brannaman. And lately, even more introductions to some amazing modern horsemen like Tick himself, the Pirellis, Dan James, Jonathan Field. So there's been like a lot of great influences in my life, and they've kind of all been connected in small ways, but it's been, you know, a huge evolution.
So have you always planned on being an equine professional, or was there, you mentioned you tried doing some
dabbled.
Kept coming back to horses, but
yeah.
Have horses always been your plan?
Yeah. You know, I think the people who knew me when I was growing up in Pony Club would have said, yes, like there's nothing else she was going to do. But I, you know, my mom was really adamant that I go to college, and I was ready to just do horses straight out of high school, you know, but I'm really glad that I went to college. There was not an industry that I was like, yes, I really want a degree in that, because when I finished college, I knew I was just going to do horses. So the only other thing that I just loved in my life was art. And so I actually got my BFA. And then,
wow.
Yeah. And then when I was doing horses for a while, I came to a point where I needed a minute. I think we might talk about that at some point here. I'm sure it'll come up, but I dabbled then for quite a while in social service and worked in some group homes for young mothers and their children, and ended up doing a lot of parenting education around the time that I actually was having children myself, which was poignant and really useful on like a personal level, and also, you know, something I'm glad I spent some time doing in my life.
That's quite a change from a BFA to social services.
I know, right? I know. Yeah. But it's so interesting, like all, you know, between horses and the social service work and art, it all, you know, there are common threads through
yes,
all of
them. Yes, there are.
Yeah. And it's been really fun to kind of pull things, you know, from each area of my life into others, you know? Yeah, it's all connected.
So you had a pivotal turning point. You were with dabbling with horses, and then you went into social services, but then you went back into riding and you started looking at things a little bit differently. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So my turning point actually happened when I was a working professional in Virginia. Mm-hmm. I was riding a really lovely mare named Lady Lucy for an awesome owner that I had down there. And she was coming up through the levels, and we were doing our first training level, and I made just some really not good choices for her out on cross country. I ended up getting hurt. She lost her confidence in both me and in herself. And I really felt just unbelievably terrible about it. I mean, I was, you know, beating myself up in a way that I knew really wasn't healthy, but I also didn't know how not to do. And yeah. I remember I was driving home from that particular event, my ankle, you know, badly swollen and feeling like, ugh, like I just really messed up. And I had this like, it was almost like an epiphany. It was like this flash, this moment where I really recognized that the entirety of my self-worth in that moment and in life in general, my like value as a human being was being wrapped up so completely in whether or not I was winning, like whether how I was doing at competitions. And I knew something had to change. Like I just knew I had to find a healthier way, because what I was doing was not landing me or the horses I was riding in any good place.
That's quite an epiphany, and that's really pretty insightful as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel really fortunate that that happened in my early 20s. And so I was like, you know, at a place where I felt like, oh man, now I feel like I have to start over in some way. But also I was young enough to really have time to make a change that I knew I needed to make, because what I was doing was not sustainable.
Yeah. So what did you do?
Well, that's a big topic. You know, that incident led me to really question some big things in life and in the world. You know, the idea of self, the idea of ego, the idea of suffering. And I just went searching. You know, I started reading a lot of books. Eventually, I found my way to a Buddhist retreat center that was near me. I was doing a lot of reading of, you know, the ideas of Eastern cultures and Buddhist philosophy. And I found a community near the Charlottesville, Virginia area, founded by a man named Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche. And I did a retreat there around my birthday in May of 2007. And it was like, it was really life changing. I ended up, you know, really connecting with that community and ended up in an organization called Three Doors that was founded by the same person, which teaches non-secular meditation practices to communities and people all over the world. And they run something called the Three Doors Academy, which is like a 2.5-year program that really, really asks people to dive in deep and use these practices and tools to examine how we move through our life, you know, and how we relate to the world and the people around us and our communities. And it was really revolutionary. Like, it really changed how I move through the world and relate to myself and other people. And it's continued to evolve, you know, in my personal practice over the years since. I'm still really connected to that community, which is like a wonderful base of support for me. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in turn, that really just changed my ability to be present with horses and relate to them without excess emotion and without, you know, delving too much into the past or too much into the future. I can meet them where they are. And I can do the same for myself and my students in a way that makes the work I do now not only sustainable, but actually, you know, joyful and, you know, something I want to be doing daily.
Well, that's sort of what social services is all about, isn't it? It's starting where the client is. It's starting from now and being present in the now. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know, what I meant, that there's this common thread. Like, when you can, I think that when you learn how to be with yourself and be with the present moment a little differently than a lot of people generally do, it affects your whole life. You know, it affects how I am with my children and my husband and my clients and the horses and, you know, the people I worked with in social service. So yeah, it's all connected in that way.
So you are an event rider. You've been an event rider and you still do that, but you also enjoy dressage and you have, as part of this whole journey and some of the names you mentioned, obviously you do a lot of groundwork with your horses and your training. So how were you first introduced to those principles and what drew you to them?
Yeah. So Steve, the trainer I mentioned before that I grew up with, he always taught me these basics that I thought were just normal, like that everybody taught their horses good boundaries and mutual respect. And I thought that these were just skills that were part of everyone's repertoire.
If only.
I know. I feel so lucky looking back that he was one of my first influences, because, you know, when I started running my own businesses and I would look around, I was like, whoa, this is not how everybody relates to horses. And then when I ran my first farm in the northern corner of Tennessee, the owner of that farm dropped a few more pebbles in that pond, and she gave me a few more principles and ideas, and she gave me my first rope halter. You know, that was really another little like turning point where I was like, huh, there's more here to know. And it slowly just grew from there until I got a horse called Unexpected, or Eddie, we called him in the barn. He's actually who my current farm is named after. He just needed something different. You know, he needed a different approach because of where he was at. And it really called upon me to increase my skill set and look at other ways to relate to him. And then I saw Tick teaching at Equine Affair. And, you know, I was like, this is the stuff I'm doing. And here's a person who's connecting it to his work in the event world. And here's a person who's bridging that gap between like these good foundational basics and these understandings of horses that not everybody, you know, gets taught when they're young. And he's connecting that to the competition world. And I got really excited because, you know, it was becoming a little more mainstream in the way that I was trying to make it in my own work. So, yeah.
Right. Because for a long time, it was very, I guess, a little more Western oriented and a little more like, this is what you do. You do, quote unquote, natural horsemanship. And it doesn't, they didn't necessarily show how it could apply to your riding or or to competition, like what you said, and how it how it kind of crossed over. So, you know, and I mean, apparently you were introduced to some of those ideas, like you said, without really knowing it. And I kind of the same way, my mentor always taught his horses, boundaries and personal space and all that sort of thing. It wasn't a thing though. It was
It's just the way we did it.
Yeah, exactly. So you sort of were doing it long before you really knew you were doing it. But so did you think it would apply to your sport, or, you know, did Tick kind of help really show you how that could happen?
Well, you know, because I grew up and it was just what we did, I didn't understand enough about basic animal behavior and training principles. Like it was just what we did, you know, there wasn't like too much theory behind it.
Right.
And when I saw things that were like more complicated, like when I would watch like a Liberty trainer or something, it all seemed like very magical. Like, whoa, how are they making that happen? But I knew it was something I like wanted to be able to do because the connection between the horse and the rider or the handler was so apparent, you know? And then, you know, once I educated myself about some of the ideas and theories behind the techniques and the magic, basically, it just made sense. Like, it wasn't magic. It was just understanding how horses learn. I always felt like from the beginning with the stuff that Steve instilled in my basic handling of horses, like those skills around leading, standing at the mounting block, working on the line, that I had like a bit of a leg up on riders who had to lead the horses with chain shanks or like be tossed up onto a moving target at the horse shows. And that seemed to prove true in my riding career and for my students, you know, like I brought a lot of difficult horses along and had a lot of success moving up through the levels. And I feel like my students had that same kind of leg up. Like our horses were calm at the horse shows. They could walk with us quietly. We could get on without there being a fiasco. You know, they were more relaxed and able to work out in competition. So I saw the practical application, but now I know more and know that it really, really does.
Well, the concept that you're a team and that there has to be a relationship, I struggle with this with young people who want to just get on and ride. Yeah. And they don't want to do the whole horsemanship. They don't know how to handle their horses on the ground, how to lead them. You know, your horse has to lead correctly with you or you can get hurt.
Yeah.
Exactly. That relationship that you have on the ground does translate on their backs.
It 100% does.
And people don't get that. So it's brilliant that you have incorporated all of that into your business model, into your students and the people that you work with. And it's such a bonus for your horses as well, because, you know, horses are herd animals and they need somebody to lead.
Yeah.
And most of them don't want to be the leaders.
Yeah. You know, like they need, you know, that sense of understanding what the job is and how to answer the questions so that their anxiety stays low. You know, they're prey animals and they are always on the lookout for things that are going to get them. And so if we can help their world be very understandable, then their anxiety level stays low and their ability to learn is more present.
Yes. So you're an event rider, but you really love dressage, which is very unusual, Chelsea.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. Most event riders do the dressage to get through it so that they can go, you know, run fast and jump high. But you see the dressage as a little bit more than that.
Yeah. I mean, when you get good scores in dressage, you're more likely to win at your event, right?
Yeah.
I love finishing on my dressage score and being at the top of the leaderboard the whole time. You know, why not start there? It makes sense.
The Olympics just showed that, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think even as a young person, I've always been really amazed by the seamlessness of it when it's done well. You know, I feel that way about the Liberty work. I feel that way about a good hunter round. Like, I want all my show jumping to look like that. I just really love the way in dressage, the connection between horse and rider is super evident when they can show like a quiet, relaxed, but also like athletic and powerful test under the pressure of competition. Like, that doesn't just happen through muscle. That happens through finesse and through a mutual understanding. And I think it says a lot about the basics that a rider has cultivated with their horse when they can put in a test like that and then still go out and gallop cross country and then bring it all back together for show jumping.
It's nice to see. And actually, I think, and you probably can speak to this a little better than I can, that since the format of eventing has changed to the shorter format, dressage has become more important, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I 100% think so. You know, obviously the type of horse that we're seeing out at the upper levels of competition has really changed. And because of the shortening of the format, we're seeing, you know, quite a good many warm bloods at the very top who maybe couldn't have run the long format. And their athleticism is huge. And they can put in dressage tests, you know, with the best of them out in the straight dressage world. And so why not, you know, why not embrace that and really show off that ability to do both amazing flat work and jump around really well.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we talk about with classical dressage or straight dressage versus eventing dressage is that dressage riders do only one sport. And they specialize in it, and that's what they do. Whereas an eventing horse is a triathlete. And the thing that's so exciting about eventing is that there are three very different disciplines. And I know Jimmy Wofford talks a lot about the fact that an event horse cannot do dressage in the same way that a just dressage horse does, because the idea of submission is a little bit different, that a dressage horse has to be submissive to the rider and listen to the aids, where an event horse has to at some point, particularly at the upper levels, think for himself or they run into trouble. Yeah. So how do you reconcile that with your more natural horsemanship approach and your groundwork approach? How do you teach the horse to be able to listen and be on your aids in the sandbox, but then be more independent out cross country?
You know, that's a really great question, actually. I love that.
Thank you.
So one of the first things that I teach all the horses on the ground is curiosity. Because, you know, horses being prey animals, their instinct when something is new or different or frightening or erratic is to leave, right? They want to get out of there. So, but they can't do that if they're going to run around a cross country course, or even if they're going to do well in a dressage arena. Right. So they need to become curious about their surroundings and want to investigate. And that curiosity can be cultivated and can grow into like tenacity. You know, like when you have a horse that at first is worried about the way, like, you know, a particular jump looks, and you can teach them that investigating, going and sniffing, touching, looking at, you know, being around those things is actually interesting and not frightening, then that skill slowly expands until they're like, ooh, what's that? Oh, I want to go see that. Let's go over there and check that out. And that can build and build and build until they're like, let me add it, you know? And I don't think that, you know, it's one or the other. Like, you can have a horse that's incredibly responsive and respectful to the aids and very submissive to the aids, but you can also signal them when it's time for them to go be curious and investigate and be a little tenacious and say, all right, it's on you. Check it out. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. That's a really interesting way of looking at things. You know, we have a tendency, we dressage riders tend to be a little bit wimpy about stuff. And so we're into avoidance. I love that idea of cultivating curiosity and making the curiosity something that they can feel proud of and strong in.
Yeah. I've got a woman who recently became a client of mine who was on a horse and that she's been partnered with for quite a long time. And they're, you know, strictly dressage riders, and their bubble, their like world had gotten so small because she was afraid and the horse was afraid. Yeah. And everything just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk until like she was wrestling with the horse to try to keep its head down so it wouldn't look at anything and therefore wouldn't be scared. And they could ride on a 20-meter circle in the middle of the ring. And she was sad about that. And the horse was worried. And so we like stripped it back and we taught it how to be curious. And now she's like, she's riding in the outdoor with the brand new mirrors being installed, and I'm weed whacking, and there's a, you know, lawnmower going, and, you know, the horse is coming in, and they're like loving life again, yeah. You know, and the horse just needed to be taught that he was fine to check things out.
Right.
And that horse and rider are much happier for it.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I judged a fix a test yesterday, and there was a lot of stuff going on during the rides. You know, the tent kind of lost part of its roof, and there was somebody who was mowing, and there was a lot of traffic. And, you know, it was interesting because the way that we all approached it was sort of, you know, oh, all of this stuff going on and the horse needs to learn and experience it and get through it and trust the rider that it's okay.
Yeah.
But we didn't really experience it, I think, in the same way that you're talking about. And I think the way that you're talking about would make it so much more manageable and so much better for the horse and the rider.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it takes time. Like, you have to be able... It's interesting because it feels like it takes a lot of time up front, but it's amazing how quickly things like snowball.
Yes.
Once the horse has that feeling, you know, like you want to take that time because you're going to get to where you actually want to be way faster if you just take it.
Yeah.
That is very good advice for all of us in many things.
Yeah.
So that patience, Aviva, patience.
Yeah, I don't know the meaning of that word.
So speaking of dressage, you have Laura Graves coming to your farm for 2-day clinic, which I'm very excited about because I am going to be up there and we're going to be filming for...
I'm jealous.
I know.
Come on.
And our video subscription site. So what made, you know, first of all, Laura is obviously a big name. She's an Olympian and, you know, so what about her stood out to you? Have you ridden with her before or, you know, how do you know her? How'd you get her up there? And what are your expectations?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate that one of my current clients had a very well-bred young horse that we decided was better suited for the straight dressage track than for eventing. And so after I put some good basics on him, this woman, Leslie, had a connection with Laura from a clinic she had gone to audit. And so she connected with Laura about him and Laura agreed to take him on. So while he was with her, I got to go down and ride him a few times to see what they were working on and where things were at in case the owner decided to keep him as a dressage ride. So while I was down there, I got to connect with Laura a bit and commiserate with her about, like, you know, our New England roots. And she's, you know, a lovely person as well as a lovely rider. And so I've got this amazing new facility here in Maine, and I'm working really hard to make sure we can bring quality education up here. Maine is a bit of a, you know, far off destination for a lot of really good clinicians, and it's where my family is. And I want it to also become a destination for the region. I want my farm to be a place where people are wondering what's coming next. And I think Laura coming is a nice way to put us on the map. So I'm really excited to have her up and have such, you know, a prestigious dressage rider here in just the first year of our new farm.
My last question for you is something that we like to ask everybody on our interviews. And you've alluded to this a little bit throughout your entire, all the questions that you answered, but what do you feel makes a good horse person?
That's a huge question as well, isn't it?
It is a huge question. So.
Well, and bear with me. I'll try to give a useful answer without going on too long. You know, I think the first thing is that they need to understand that horses exist in the present. They don't exist in the past or the future in the way most people do. And I think the ability for people to be present is really difficult. Like, we spend our time thinking about the past and thinking about what's coming next more often than we do just exist in the now. And that ability to be present with a horse and meet them where they are is so essential for good work. And I think when you watch the best horse people in the world, you can see it. Like, they go into that zone when they're with their horse and they are nowhere else. And I think, you know, the meditation work that I do and the tools that I give my riders that come from that space really promote that quality of presence that I think is 100% necessary. Without it, you can't have good feel for what the horse is trying to do, and you can't have good timing to help the horse understand what you want through, you know, the appropriate release of pressure at the right moments. And you also can't see when the horse is trying if you're not present. You have to be able to catch them when they put the effort in and attempt to give you the right answer so that you can show them they're on the right track. And unless you're really, really present in the moment, you can't do that. I think a really good horse person knows that they don't know everything and that they don't have the one right answer and that they are always, always seeking to learn. And I think on that same note, you know, they work really hard to cultivate better work in themselves, better feel, better timing, better position, and that they really work to find the joy in those small victories as well as the large. You know, they're psyched when they win a competition, but they're also psyched when their horse, you know, figures out how to move away from a specific pressure. And they celebrate that like 1% better in their people and in their animals. And it's just obvious that they're in it for the love of the horse.
Oh, I so wish I were close to Maryland.
Well, you know, you're always welcome in Maine.
Thank you.
This has been a really kind of enlightening, conversation. And I'm very excited to meet you in person and to go up there. And we'll be filming with you as well. So we'll have more from Chelsea coming very soon. But thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. I look forward to seeing you soon, Stephanie.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. This has been such a pleasure. I'm looking forward to getting to know you better, even if it's only through the internet.
Sounds great, Aviva. Thanks.
Many thanks to Chelsea Kennedy for talking with us today.